Hello everyone, it's Tom here. Before we get into this episode of Last Orders, I just want to let you know about a couple of ways that you can support this show. The first one takes no time and no money at all, and that is to give us a glowing five-star rating on your favourite podcast app. It takes no time at all, and it's a really great way to help us reach new people. The other is that if you like this podcast, if you've been listening and enjoying it, if you like the work that we do here at Spike, please do consider making a donation or even becoming a signed up monthly Spike supporter. To do that, just go to spiked-online.com/donate to find out more. Thanks so much. Thank you for your support. And now on with the show. Welcome to Last Orders, the Spike podcast all about freedom and the nanny state. In this episode, we discuss Just Stop Oil's shameful assault on the snooker, the prospects of state-funded vaping, and the genius of PG Woodhouse. Hello and welcome to Last Orders. I'm Tom Slater, editor of Spiked, joined as I am in every episode by Chris Snowden from the Institute of Economic Affairs. Hello, Chris, how are you doing?
Hi, Tom. Pleasure to be here yet again. Episode 58. They're coming 58. Thick and fast these days, aren't they?
And we're delighted to be joined on our 58th episode. It had to be. Dominic Frisby, returning guest. How are you doing, Dominic?
I'm very well, thanks. And I feel honoured to have been chosen as the man for the 58th edition.
Now, you do many things, Dominic. You're an author, you're a comedian, self-described internet odd job man, but you've always got something in the pipeline. Is there anything that you want to plug for our listeners out
well,
there?
I'm delighted to be able to get in the early plug, so I'm going to plug two things, if that's
please
okay
do.
The first is basically my life's mission, which is to realize this story of my father's, which is all about vaccines in World War II, and it's a 10-part serialized podcast with music called Kisses on a Postcard, and we just won in the New York Festivals Radio Awards, which apparently is the Oscars of radio. We just won silver in Best Serialized Podcast.
Brilliant.
Awesome. So Kisses on a Postcard, listen to that. And then probably of more interest to your listeners is my Substack, The Flying Frisbee, where I write about money, markets and more.
Brilliant. Do go check those out. We'll link to everything in the show notes of this episode. We've got a lot to talk about today, but let's start with Just Stop Oil. They've just had their latest big attention-grabbing stunt. They finally hit the fossil fuel industry where it hurts, which, of course, is the World Snooker Championship. Chris, you're fresh back from Sheffield. So, of course, to anyone who hasn't seen that clip so far, this was during a match the other evening where two Just Stop Oil protesters tried to disrupt play. One of them managed to climb onto a table and empty this bag of orange powder paint over himself. And the other one, less so, tried to glue herself to the table. Got very quickly apprehended by the referee, I think. But
yes.
Chris, you weren't there, I don't think, but
no.
You were in Sheffield recently and you wrote about it, that stunt for Spike. What do you make of it?
Yeah, I've just come back from there. I was there the day after it happened. Well, what can you say? I mean, they've crossed the line, haven't they? Really, this is an assault on everything that being British is about. You know, it was bad enough when they were stopping out ambulances to get to hospital, but cancelling Milkins v. Perry when there's only 11 points on the board is an atrocity, I would say, an outrage.
You should at least have done it like if it was a decider on the black.
You can tell that they're not even snooker fans, can't you? Otherwise, they would have waited to later on. I think the actual reason they did it straight away is, and you might not know this, but at the Crucible, and probably in a lot of sporting events like this, the cameramen only turn up for the first frame, really, and maybe the last one. Because they can't be bothered watching hours and hours of snooker. So in order to definitely get a photo, and to be fair, they did get a good photo of it, didn't they? You know, the orange kind of dust going in the air, it was quite dramatic. But that does not excuse for a second what they've done. These people should be put away and forever, as far as I'm concerned. This guy, Edred Whittingham.
Yes.
Edred, I think that's his name, isn't it?
They're never called like Keith or anything.
No, they? Every time there's one of these incidents, I always play the game of which school did they go to, Eton or Harrow, and it's always, Edred, he's a multiple offender. I think he's got about half a dozen convictions for similar stuff like this. I don't know what it takes for these people to get a custodial sentence. Just the Oil at the beginning of the year were moaning about how many other people were still languishing in prison, which I thoroughly enjoy. Extinction Rebellion basically retired from, you know, public disruption I think because they were sick of people getting imprisoned. So it shows that prison works. We just need to imprison these people more. Well, first offence for start off, straight to prison, and for longer and longer. And three strikes, I think, means life.
This is a libertarian podcast, of course. That's the sort of insult.
Look, libertarians are in favour of upholding the law. I just think we should have fewer laws.
Dominic, how long do you think they should serve then?
I'm not a lawyer and I don't know the details, but it does seem to be that crimes committed in the name of climate change are more excused than other types of crimes. And there's a sort of hierarchy of good crimes and bad crimes. And the fact that a lot of the time they achieve heroic status for their antics, you know, this guy's probably got loads of likes on his social media channels. I'm interested to know, listening to you talk just then, Chris, I'm going to change the subject ever so slightly, but where do you stand on castration?
That's a very good idea in this particular instance.
I didn't see this coming.
This guy specifically doesn't think people should have children. He's one of these people who thinks that there isn't going to be a world worth living in to bring them into. So he wouldn't be too bothered about that threat. I suppose it depends how brutally you do it.
My friend who comes from a very rich family and is like...
Is he called Idrid?
No, he's called Gideon. comes from a very rich and very kind of left-wing luxury views kind of rich family from Hampstead, who has worked for 30 years in a school for problem children. And he is like as guardian reading left-wing as you'll get. And he has suddenly announced that castration is the only answer, having dealt, you know, firsthand with problem children, because he says it's generational, you know, the problem family one leads on to the other. And I was amazed to hear somebody as nominally...
Oh, so it's not as a punishment, it's just as eugenics, basically. That's what you mean. I see, right.
I should just say, to take us away from castration for just one moment, but it is the sort of thing where it's interesting that they are losing the room, because you do get that sense that even people... I mean, the media were certainly very much more in their favour previously, would give them a pretty easy going over whenever they would have... And their protest, that seems to have ended. It is worth saying that there have been all of these quite draconian anti-protest measures mooted and actually introduced over the last couple of years, largely in response to Extinction Rebellion. You had the Policing Bill Now Act, which is the one that clamped down on one-person protests and brought in restrictions on noise and so on. There's the new Public Order Bill, which looks to bring this very Blairite-sounding Serious Disruption Protection Order, which is, again, these kind of, I think, pretty authoritarian, preemptive restrictions on people's movement, who they can move around and stuff. My question in all this, though, is surely it's always been illegal, something that the police can deal with, when you're walking out into the middle of the motorway or gluing yourself to the DLR. And yet, despite that, they weren't able to do anything about it. And yet, yeah, they feel the need to bring in all of these different...
Well, I never understood that. Really, I mean, I thought there was a law against obstructing the Queen's Highway. Maybe there isn't. I don't know. But yeah, it did seem as if they weren't able to do very much about these people gluing themselves to the road. And in particular, the police weren't willing to do anything about it. So whether or not there was a law, the police weren't doing very much about it. And
well, they've given them quite a friendly reception needed anything.
Well, the motorists started doing something about it. That was the thing, wasn't it? The motorists started being less passive about being pointlessly stopped on their way to work or going to the dying mother's hospital bed and so on. So that was great to see. A bit of vigilanteism in there. Gave things on the libertarian tick. Anything to add, Dominic?
I very much a favour of the vigilante and of the citizen journalist, because a lot, you know, it's citizen journalists a lot of the time are essentially vigilantes, and they're bringing stuff to public attention that otherwise wouldn't be brought to public attention. And as a result, there's public outcry, and there's resulting pressure placed on politicians to actually do something about it. If politicians are expected to do something about something of their own volition, they very rarely do. It's only when they come under some kind of pressure to do it that they do. And I would agree with your comment, Tom, that they're losing the room.
They certainly lost the crucible.
Yeah. It reminds me a bit of the NHS, whereas, you know, 10 or 15 years ago, you could not criticise the NHS, and now suddenly a few people, you know, reality has struck and it's become acceptable. I'm noticing in comedy clubs, people haven't gone as far yet as criticise doctors and nurses, but they're criticising the admin staff. So that's a sort of, that's a step in the direction. And I think, you know, you could not question climate change. And now suddenly, you know, there's a lot of stuff to do with net zero that's coming out, that it requires four times as much metal to be mined to make an electric car as it does a normal car. All this kind of, you know, Extinction Rebellion you know, 15 minutes, is that the whole thing is being questioned in a way, and yeah, they're losing the room.
I mean, it seems to me they don't really care whether people hate them or not. They don't even really care if they're successful. They seem to be in this because they are disturbed individuals or narcissists or something. They must realize that stopping people getting to work and, you know, yeah, chucking paint all over the table at the Crucible is not going to win them any friends. And I just saw a YouGov poll earlier showing that most people, whether you're Labour, Remain, Leave, whatever, there's a majority of people view them unfavorably, and they don't care. Ash Sarkar from Navarra Media said something particularly stupid the other day about this. She said that people hated the suffragettes too.
I almost thought that was a wind-up. It was so kind
right.
Of
bad, I mean, know. Being hated, people get hated for a lot of reasons, sometimes fairly, sometimes unfairly. The fact that just the wall are hated doesn't make them anything like the suffragettes, for a start. Secondly, the suffragettes didn't have a vote, right? These people have a vote. So the suffragettes couldn't do anything other than take direct action. And thirdly, once the suffragettes got the vote, they stopped doing all these demonstrations and protests. And just the poor really have got, they haven't obviously got exactly what they want, because it's totally unrealistic to expect the UK economy to be fully decarbonized by 2025, which is what Extinction Rebellion want. But the whole of the political class are basically on their side. There's a reason these judges keep letting them off with a slap on the wrist and saying you're good people, because the establishment agrees with them.
Yeah.
So they've already won.
Well, that was the thing. On the one hand, the nature of the protest, it does feel like it's the most extreme example yet of something that's been clear for a very long time now, which is that protests, whilst once would have been conceived of as, you know, the voice of the unheard, people who had no other kind of alternative to make their point, it's now just a kind of strop of hysterical middle class people about whatever particular issue of the day. This, a particularly anti-democratic and disruptive form, in terms of you just want to make people's days a nightmare and count that as a win. But as you say, I mean, you know, it is just a kind of case of the political class agrees we should have some measure of eco-austerity. There's just the timetable's different, and right, they're upset that it's not happening.
And they're quite happy to have people.
But also, it's not about what it's about. This comes under that category where whatever you give them, it will never be enough. And, you know, the hashtag is smash capitalism. It's they want an end to capitalism, and it's under the guise of eco, this, that, and the other. That's how it's justified. But the real aim is to smash capitalism.
I suppose it's almost lets the government off the hook sometimes in terms of these green protests, just because of the fact that they can pass some quite draconian laws, which, as I say, I don't think will do anything other than restrict the right to protest. You could deal with these people anyway. It allows them to pose as anti-loony left and so on, because they can say we're not like these people. But yeah, a lot of the policies they're introducing, not really that different. But we should move on to another policy that the government are introducing, very much in your wheelhouse, Chris, and that is this plan to give 4 million smokers, I believe, in a trial, vape kits on the NHS, as well as, I think, giving pregnant women about £400 to keep off the cigarettes. How do you feel about this? Is this terrible state-sanctioned vaping, or is it something you could actually support?
Mixed feelings, actually. I last year, I spoke out on the radio about this policy. I was up against Action on Smoking Health. They wanted to give people free vapes, and I was saying, no, we shouldn't. And my argument then was that these are basically recreational products. They're not particularly expensive. They're much cheaper than a pack of fags. And if you want to go out and get yourself an elf bar, then you just go out and do that. The only reason I've changed my mind about this, and this is a bit of element of 4D chess, but the main problem with the kind of vaping at the moment is the perception of it, right? The public understanding about the relative risks of vaping and smoking have gone backwards around the world. And there's now, I think, more people think that vaping is as bad or worse than smoking than understand that it is much, much less dangerous than smoking. And I think because of what economists would call the information asymmetry there, in other words, the public are systematically misinformed about this, there's consumer ignorance on a large scale, I think you could call that a market failure, and you can justify.
I'm in that category. I'm in that category of people who'd come around to thinking over the last few months that vaping was worse than
really?
Smoking.
Right.
I don't know quite why I came to believe that. It's just one of those things that had filtered.
And you're an intelligent guy. So this is happening all the time because of all this junk science coming over, mainly from America and scaremongering and so on. So I think there is, just on sort of mainstream economic grounds, justification for the government to try and correct this information asymmetry. And it could spend millions and millions of pounds on some advertising campaign, and it might have some effect. But actually, I think the signaling effect of the NHS giving people e-cigarettes is more powerful than anything in getting people to go, actually, they can't be that bad. Otherwise, the NHS wouldn't be giving them to pregnant women or to whoever, smokers.
So they're going to give them to people in order to get people off smoking?
Yeah. And I'm not sure
they opposed that 7 or 8 years ago, didn't they?
Who, the Tories?
They, you know, the
public health people.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, the public health people have come around to them in this country. We're one of the very few countries where we have public health establishment who are so pro-vaping. But, you know, they've seen it work, right? I mean, the smoking rate has really dropped a lot in the last few years as a result of vaping. The evidence is pretty incontrovertible. And there's been no evidence of a gateway effect.
Okay.
Right? People are a bit concerned about how much...
smoking.
Well, there we go, yeah. and there is concern about the number of teenagers vaping. We've discussed this before on the show. Government has, at the same time as announcing this, whatever it's called, vape swaps scheme, they've said there's going to be, they'll put more money into trading standards, which is what we said in the very last episode, wasn't it, with Mark Littlewood, who said, well, just enforce the law we've already got. You know, kids are not supposed to be buying these things. Let's stop them buying them. So actually, I think this announcement is pretty good on balance. And don't forget, smokers massively subsidize non-smokers anyway, right? So if smokers get a little bit of it back in free vapes, then I don't think anyone's got any real cause for concern.
I mean, also, it could have been so much worse given how crazy a lot of the advice government is getting on questions.
Yeah.
I mean, what was it? The Khan review was last year?
Khan review was all being basically thrown out by the government.
Which is great. I mean, because the stuff that was in there, if memory serves, it was putting smoking kills warnings on individual cigarettes.
Yeah, and making the cigarettes green and increasing the age at which you can buy them by a year every year until no one can buy them anymore.
So that's it could have been rejected. A lot worse.
It could be a hell of a lot worse.
But what do you think on this front, Dominic? Do you think this is a good policy?
Well, my first guiding principle is anything that involves more government activity is bad, and therefore the state should be getting less involved in stuff and not more involved in stuff. That is my first guiding principle. But my second guiding principle is that Chris Snowden is usually right about most things, especially public health related. So in this regard, I'm going to defer to him.
And this is all, as you were suggesting there, Chris, kind of wrapped up with the general anti-smoking drive, this smoke-free by 2030, which I think is what, down to 5% of people smoking.
Are not, we on not very smoke-free, is it that?
No, not really.
Millions of people still smoking. But
are we on track for that? I heard the usual kind of concern that we're going completely down the wrong road from all the usual suspects, but is that true?
I mean, it's going like down. It's not looking like if it carries on going down at the current rate, it's going to go below 5% in 7 years.
We want negative smoking numbers.
Right,
we want a minus number. But
frankly, who cares whether we hit this target or not? It's none of the government's business. This is just something that Theresa May came up with in the fag end of her premiership because she wanted to be remembered for something other than messing up Brexit. It was never even in like the Conservative manifesto, let alone debated in Parliament.
Wasn't net zero her? As well,
yeah,
that
yeah,
particular
yes, right. Indeed, yeah, yeah. So these, you know, these stupid targets, they and the idea that they're in some way legally binding. I mean, is Theresa May going to go to prison if 6% of people are smoking in 2030? I hope so.
Try Jolene Moore to test it out in court.
No, let's get someone who knows what they're doing to test it out.
it's so strange that this is even a topic of government focus, really, when people are smoking, as you say, already make a lot of money out of
smoking. World we're living now, Tom. World we're living.
Exactly. Let's move on. Let's talk about PG Wodehouse. This is another one in a string of stories, Dominic, of essentially publishing houses and even the estates of very esteemed authors directing sensitivity readers, or in this case, they've just done it off their own backs, to take these old cherished novels and to take the red pen to them. In this particular case, there's been a couple of Jeeves and Worcester novels, which have had... supposedly the racial language, it seems like the N-word and so on, have been removed from it. They've also added trigger warnings, essentially, to the beginning of each of these things, indicating that some of the language was unacceptable and also reminding readers that these were written in the 1930s, and so they might be a little bit dated, which I don't think anyone really needed to be told. What do you make of all this? Because out of the three of us, I know you're the only person who has actually read a P.G. Wodehouse novel, so that's a set of expertise that we don't have. So please do tell us what you make of all
this. Okay, so when a famous rock star dies, like say when David Bowie dies or something, you sort of get this outpouring on social media and there's almost like this competition to be the person who liked David Bowie the most. You know, this sort of weird dynamic. And in a way, Wodehouse has been killed because his work has been violated. And so there's this big outpouring. But I challenge anyone in the world to like Wodehouse and know more about Wodehouse than me. So we start this conversation with that premise. I got very kind of lost and depressed in my 20s. And then I sort of discovered P.G. Wodehouse. And I just read and read and read him. And I became totally obsessed with him. And he's written something like 100, close to 100 books. And some of them he wrote under pseudonym. So we don't even know all the books he's read. And I think I've read pretty much all of them. And I even went as far as I was so obsessed with how somebody could write such brilliant comic books. I took a P.G. Wodehouse book and rewrote it almost sentence for sentence in modern language, sort of updated it to the modern world.
Perfect. That's what they're doing now.
I was ahead of my time. In order to understand, you know, the kind of how his mind worked, to try and better understand his techniques and so on. And the first thing about Wodehouse is he's like, his golden age was probably from about the late 20s through to the 60s, that sort of 30 or 40 year period. But everything he set, but it feels like his stuff is much older because his stuff was sort of set in this fantasy, Edwardian, idyllic Britain before the First World War. I mean, he never actually dated anything, but it felt in this sort of harmless Britain. You have to judge things, I think, by their intent. And we often conflate in this modern world where everything gets conflated, speech with violence, you know, words with actual physical violence. And if you look at the intent with which everything Wodehouse did, he was the most harmless, gentle. He meant no ill will to anyone. And like, if you're censoring Wodehouse, the world he created, it wasn't like Orwell's 1984 or Tolkien's Middle Earth or anything like that. It was the most gentle, idyllic, that like the most dangerous thing in the Wodehousean world is an aunt with a vicious tongue. Like, that is about as vicious as it gets. And it's just this beautiful, and Simon Evans compares him to, you know, he did for literature what Bach did for music. And it's a brilliant comparison. It was just gentle and there is a music to his prose.
And so, given you've said all that as well, because it was quite, and I know you've got some quotations for us here, which we should get into, because that's one of the things that's surely most arrogant about these rewrites, which is to say you've got this author. And in this case, as I understand it, you know, often praises the greatest comic author in the English language and so on. Refer to the master by all these different people, and you think, oh, we can just lose that. We can get rid of that. We can change that. We can swap it. I mean, that's an incredibly arrogant position to take.
It's an arrogance and it's a violation. And after the Roald Dahl thing, when they backed down eventually, I was amazed to hear that they'd done this. But in the case of Wodehouse, it is only an occasional use of the N-word. But the use of the N-word there was no malevolence. It was just to describe a certain type of music hall act. I mean, that was all it was referenced to. He wasn't advocating the persecution of a particular race on the grounds of creed or colour or anything like that. So you can't construe it as racism. It's just that the meaning of that word has changed over time. And you could say, well, it's only a tiny little change because he's only changing the N-word to something else. But it is still a violation. And I think the madness that goes with the use of the N-word now and all the emotions that it provokes in people, the more that gets pandered to, the worse the madness around this word will be. And you get incidents where, like, you know, you'll have one person that is thought might have used this word at one stage, but they didn't quite hear it. And then they're literally beaten to a pulp. And I see it on social media, that, you know, violence that they will never recover from in their life.
There's an incredible page on Wikipedia, which is all about the word niggardly. And basically all these instances in which people have been sacked, lost their jobs, etc., for using that phrase. And there was another one recently, which isn't the same word.
And it's completely different etymology.
Exactly. No sort of common etymological ancestry at all. Completely different. There was a similar one recently where it was a professor in America somewhere, in California, I think, who was teaching some sort of class, and he used the Chinese word nega, that is often used as the kind of sort of word, fill word. Okay. And because people took offense to that, even though he explained what it meant in the moment, he ended up being sacked or at least suspended, I think. So there's this, as you say, there is this hyper, you understand why the word has that power and toxicity and so on. But if you're in the business of cleansing old novels and sacking people and they haven't even used the word, something's gone very wrong, isn't it?
Yeah, I agree. And that's absolutely right. And there's too much heat on this word, and the more that heat gets pandered to, the worse it gets. And I speak as someone with mixed race kids growing up in Southeast London, you know, and every teenage boy wants to be a rapper or whatever. And there's this weird sort of two-tiered thing amongst, you know, largely equal socio and economic groups in Southeast London, where one group can use the word and one you can't. And it's just insane.
I want to close the section with your quotes, but Chris, any take on this particular historical cancellation, as it were.
Oh, just a thought that occurred to me. I happened to be looking at Gerry Adams' Wikipedia page last week. And, you know, there's usually a controversy section in people's Wikipedia pages where basically there's people who don't like them sticking all the stuff that's potentially bad about them. The only thing in the Gerry Adams controversy section is him using the N-word in a tweet in 2016. The most controversial thing about Gerry Adams.
This is what I'm talking about the conflation of speech and violence. Do you see what I mean? That's one bad word misjudge use, and look at all the violence that's gone on.
Right, yeah, it's worse than the violence, in fact, yeah. Well, I mean, like, I think when we were talking about Roald Dahl, I said, I suspect a lot of this is marketing stuff. I noticed on the Tube before that they're advertising all the James Bond books again. Mm. Interesting, all reissued. I don't know if they're in this bolderized version or not. But it does seem to be a way to get people to buy these books. I'm now going to go out and buy some P.G. Wodehouse because I read Simon Evans' article and spiked about it and heard Dominic's eulogy towards him. So, yeah, maybe it's working. I'll just buy the secondhand version, I guess, cause I usually do for old books. But yeah, is it marketing or something else? I don't know. I'm against it. If it was just the N-word, I would probably go, well, kind of fair enough. In a multiracial society these days, it is a particularly toxic word, blah, blah, blah. But it doesn't. We saw this with the Roald Dahl thing. It's not. That isn't the limit of their ambitions. The Roald Dahl stuff was ludicrous. It was like, we can't say that this woman's fat. We can't say that this child's ginger or ugly or has a big nose. You know, it's just... So as always with these things, there's a slippery slope, isn't there? And it's usually better not to go down it at all.
So before we move on to our postbag section, Dominic, is there a quote or two that you'd like to
share with us? Well, if you've never read any Wodehouse, probably the Jeeves ones are the best. And like Right Ho Jeeves is a sort of classic midlife that came in the middle of Wodehouse's era. And it contains one of the great scenes where Gussie Fink Nottle has to deliver the prize giving at the school ceremony and turns up drunk. So that's one of the great scenes, Right Ho Jeeves. Jeeves and the Feudal Spirit was the first Wodehouse I ever read, and it's just beautiful. And then he wrote the Jeeves novels, he wrote the Lord Emsworth novels, and various other, but he also wrote lots of one-off novels. And I think he said the best book he ever wrote was a book called Quick Service, which is a sort of romantic comedy. And so those are three good starting books to read. And then I'll give you, we can do a couple of very quick quotes. How about this one? The fascination of shooting as a sport depends almost wholly on whether you are at the right or wrong end of the gun. And what else have we got? The voice of love seemed to call me, but it was a wrong number. And Freddie experienced the sort of abysmal soul sadness which reflects one of Tolstoy's Russian peasants when, after putting in a heavy day's work strangling his father, beating his wife and dropping the baby into the city's reservoir, he turns to the cupboards only to find the vodka bottle empty.
Very good.
He was a master of the transferred epithet.
Go out and buy those secondhand copies.
Let's dip into the postbag.
Dip into the postbag where our listeners can send in their questions.
Postbag, postbag, postbag.
It's bulging, eh?
We've got a couple here about Just Stop Oil, funnily enough. I'm going to combine them, and I'm going to... We've obviously covered you two gentlemen's preferred methods to tackle with them, insofar as very long prison sentences or even ideally some form of castration. But if we might address this question from John Bryan, which is what you do about them whilst also protecting protests. So I don't have a problem with protesting, says John, and protesting for a political cause is a strong tradition in this country, including at sporting events. What should the state be doing to allow/prevent political protests? What's the line, essentially, I guess, is what he's saying. Or is it just the aims of Just Stop Oil and Animal Rising, which are, quote, wrong? Chris, what do you think?
It just seems to me that punishment should be, to some extent at least, based on how many people you inconvenience or upset by your actions, you know? And maybe this is a bit difficult to quantify, but, I mean, the Just Stop Oil guy doing what he did in the Crucible is clearly worse than if he did it in my local snooker club. Well, he wouldn't do it in my local snooker club because he'd get battered by the members. But it inconveniences more people and is designed to inconvenience more people. Similarly, if you're blocking some little country road, nobody's going down, that's got to be less bad than blocking Trafalgar Square and stopping hot, you know, ambulances going there. But it seems to me that the consequences of the protest, you know, have to play a part in the sentencing in some way. If you're going to go out of your way to inconvenience people, then I think you kind of quantify the inconvenience. And as we said before, unlimited sentences potentially if you inconvenience millions of people trying to watch.
So Is it almost what you're saying is that if the process is quite effective, then it should be more harshly punished?
Well, if you consider it effective to piss off millions of people, if that's effective, then yeah, I guess so, yeah.
This is a very strange debate, because on the one hand, you get people pretending as if blocking the roads doesn't mean anything. Like, the right to protest is not like an indivisible liberty. There are obvious points in which you inconvenience people. You also break other laws if you're, again, gluing yourselves to
criminal damage,
all these different stuff. But at the same time, it does feel like the kind of things that are being discussed, like these kind of preemptive measures, these, we're going to ban you from associating with these people, with carrying this kind of bike lock or whatever it was. I mean, it does seem like they're going down this kind of path, which seems like it's only going to really eat away at the right to protest. Surely it should be uncontroversial and surely legally sound to, when someone is blocking a roadway, to take them out of it.
And of course you are right, but you've got me at the wrong time, because this is within 24 hours of Just Up All ruining the snooker. I'm still very angry about it and therefore feeling quite fash.
This is an emotional response. What do you think, Dominic? What's the way to deal with it? Other than castration. We've covered that. And I'm hoping that was at least semi-ingestible.
Castration for repeat offenders. I don't know, because it annoys me when people go to prison for stuff like this because of the expense of prison. You know, so, the taxpayer's got to pay for them to go to prison as well as facing the consequences of their crime. But, you know, prison seems to work as a deterrent, and tougher sentences do work. And we seem to have got so lax, so I guess tougher sentences, but really, I'm not an expert.
Fair enough. We should close, because I know both you gentlemen have to get off. But one question I want to ask you, Dominic, we've started doing it on the show here or there, which is, given this is a kind of libertarian podcast, pertaining to asking our guests, if you had one ban, what would it be? And we want these really to be as petty and vindictive as possible. I think Chris chose wheelie suitcases. Last time we had Mark Littlewood choosing British football punditry. So again, if you've got your own kind of fantasy dictatorship, as it were, and you could just get rid of something that just really irritates you, essentially, what would it be?
Well, I'm very tempted, hearing what Mark's just said, to put a ban on former football players talking about football in public. Because
or
maybe you can only talk about football as a former player in public if you can demonstrably prove you have a vocabulary of more than 500 words. So that's one possible ban, but I think I'm going to go with fiat money.
I knew you were going to say that.
I can't believe we got half an hour in before you mentioned it. That's pretty good. Dominic, Chris, thank you very much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Last Orders. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Please do take a moment to leave us a rating and a review. And if you'd like to support the show, why not become a Spiked supporter? Just go to spiked-online.com/supporters to sign up. That's spiked-online.com/supporters.